It's time once again for the Disability News here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Welcome. On today's program, I'll be reading a piece from Art News entitled "Iconic Photographs of Blind People Prove Seeing Isn't Knowing." You'll hear a story from Arizona Public Media out of Tucson discussing the need for and resources available to support disability caregivers in these times of uncertain government funding and support. In addition, I'll be reading an article from the December issue of the Braille Monitor discussing the new Braille Access feature included in Apple's iOS 26, which was released in September of this year. Let's get started. Our first article comes from Livability Now, a publication of Ability 360. The article is entitled, "Eric Bell Puts Accessibility at Forefront at Mortgage Matchup Center." It was written by Zach Alvera. It was published December 2nd, 2025. Eric Bell is the first to admit he had no exposure to people with disabilities most of his life, though that all changed when he was in college. During a trip in eastern Washington, he drove into a lake and broke his C6 and C7 vertebrae, severing his spinal cord in the process. He was studying at the University of Washington at the time, and soon after his injury, he started to pursue a degree in disability studies. One of his courses required a capstone project. Eric, as a new wheelchair user, used it as a chance to check if a main campus building followed Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, accessibility guidelines. From there, everything changed. "My whole perspective changed," Eric said. "That's where I found out I was part of a minority category called people with disabilities. That's where I began to figure out how that fit with society. That's how I found my career path." After college, Eric served as the physical access consultant at the University of Arizona for 8 years. In January 2024, he was hired as the disability services manager for the Phoenix Suns and Phoenix Mercury. As part of his role, he is at almost every home basketball game for the two professional teams. He also attends a variety of other events at Mortgage Matchup Center, formerly PHX Arena and Footprint Center, including concerts. His main goal? Create an accessible and inclusive environment for people with disabilities. "My position is extremely important," Eric said. "Not every professional sports franchise has a full-time disability manager, so it says something about the Phoenix Suns and Mercury organization. It is a full-time job for sure. It's fast-paced and demanding. A lot of folks reach out about accessibility through our email address, accessibility@suns.com. Eric tries to ensure the availability of accessible locations for chair users. This involves swapping tickets if necessary. Sometimes this requires creativity and making last-minute changes. The one event so far that I've worked at that we just didn't have anything to work with was the Bruce Springsteen concert," Eric said. "It was a rescheduled event, so it was very sold out, and we didn't have much to work with, like we usually do. We had to be creative." Despite the sold-out crowd, Eric said he and his team found an accessible section for those who needed it. The view wasn't the best, but attendees were thankful nonetheless. Exchanging tickets is just one way Eric attempts to do his job to the best of his ability. He's set out to create an inclusive environment for people with all types of disabilities. Mortgage Matchup Center has a sensory room where individuals can go to escape an overstimulating event. It's one of the quietest rooms in the building, filled with sensory tools like textured walls to help guests manage overstimulation. Eric said those devices help relieve stress and anxiety in the moment. Eric has also aimed to improve Mortgage Matchup Center for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. Eric hopes to begin incorporating more seating options in the future, as well as increasing transparency for what attendees can expect at the venue. As a disabled person myself, one of the biggest challenges is not knowing what you're getting into before you get there, Eric said. I think one of the biggest challenges for me is getting enough accurate information into the right hands before someone comes to an event. One way we do that is our website. I'm working on getting some information on our website so folks understand what happens when you don't have accessible tickets and you need them. Eric doesn't plan on slowing down anytime soon as it relates to accessibility at Mortgage Matchup Center. He vows to make every event as enjoyable as possible for people with disabilities. After all, everyone should be able to enjoy local events. There's much fewer seats in the house for folks with disabilities compared to the general population, Eric said. It's extremely important to be able to ensure that those seats are going to the people that need the features of those seats. I think it shows to the general public that it's important disabled folks are able to enjoy the concerts, the events, the games, just like the general population. Next up is that piece from the December edition of the Braille Monitor entitled iOS 26 and Braille Access, Apple's Impressive Investment in Braille Literacy by Jonathan Mosen. In the National Federation of the Blind, we are passionate about Braille. We know that Braille is the key to literacy and to opportunity. So, when Apple released iOS 26 in September 2025, we were encouraged to see that the company had spent so much time and effort on Braille accessibility. The new Braille Access feature is the most significant accessibility advancement for blind people in this new operating system release. It demonstrates Apple's commitment to supporting Braille literacy in a way that few mainstream technology companies have done before. They have gone beyond simply supporting Braille displays to work with the device and have written software for the exclusive use of Braille users. We applaud Apple for this. Although I will be focusing on iOS 26, Braille Access is also available in iPadOS 26 and macOS 26. Before diving into the details of this feature, let me address the obvious question. How did we jump from iOS 18, which was the name of Apple's previous iPhone operating system, to iOS 26? Apple has adopted a new nomenclature across all its operating systems based on the year in which we will primarily use the operating system. Apple released iOS 26 in September 2025, but it will serve us through much of 2026. With the version numbers of Apple's operating systems varying widely, standardizing this convention makes it easier to know whether users are running the latest version. Now, back to Braille Access and why it is such a significant development. As someone who once managed several blindness note-taker products, I have firsthand experience of the challenges these access technology manufacturers face. Technology has always moved quickly, but developments have sped up dramatically with AI advancing so rapidly. It can be difficult for access technology companies to keep up because they have far fewer resources at their disposal than big tech. Some have turned to Android-based platforms, but we have seen these devices fall behind with outdated operating system versions. The iPhone becomes attractive because it keeps up with the latest technology while remaining accessible. There is an increasing number of accessible apps available, and we congratulate Apple for adding so-called accessibility nutrition labels in this release, giving developers a chance to stipulate the degree to which their apps are accessible. These nutrition labels are optional for now. We hope that once developers have had time to get used to them, they will be a requirement of submitting an app to the App Store. Yet, for all the power of using an iPhone and a Braille display, there are blind people, including some who are expert iPhone users, who still preferred the speed and ease of use of a blindness note-taker product. With iOS 26, Apple is seeking to respond to the need for that greater simplicity. Education has always been a priority for Apple, and note-takers are currently prominent in the blindness education market. Braille access represents Apple's play for this market. The value proposition is compelling. Give a student an iPad, which is something teachers, parents, and support staff already understand, and have Braille note-taker functionality on that device, along with all the benefits of using an iPad. Those with free e-readers from the National Library Service also gain significant benefit from this new feature. These devices allow reading books locally and can connect via terminal mode to other devices, but they lack built-in editing functionality. With Braille access in iOS 26, users can have note-taker-like functionality simply by pairing their NLS e-reader with their iPhone. If you have an e-reader at home and another Braille display at work or school, your Braille content can live in iCloud and be available on whatever Braille display you have to hand. Starting Braille access is straightforward. If you're using a Braille input keyboard, press dots 7 and 8 together to invoke the menu from anywhere. For an 8-dot computer Braille table, you may need to press dot-78 with the spacebar, dot-78 cord. The menu offers several powerful functions. Launch app. This allows you to quickly search for and open applications without returning to the home screen. Simply type a few characters of the app name and matching results appear. This function is available from within any app, making it convenient to invoke and switch to the app you need quickly. Choose item. This provides access to the item chooser, one of the most underutilized functions in VoiceOver for iOS. If you're not familiar with the item chooser, it is a feature worth getting to know. When you are on a busy screen, type what you're looking for, press Enter, and the system narrows results to match your query. Braille Notes. Braille access offers two file management systems, each serving different needs. Braille Notes provides a quick way to Braille into your device. The system makes no judgment or interpretation on what you're Brailing. It simply records the dots you enter. This makes it suitable not just for literary Braille, but also perfect for Braille music or personal codes. Apple stores the file in iCloud, but they aren't readily accessible through iCloud Drive on a PC. However, your notes appear on any Apple device you're logged into. BRF files. This utility offers even more power and flexibility. These files do appear in iCloud Drive, making them readily accessible on your PC, and meaning that when you copy a BRF file into the folder on iCloud Drive, it magically shows up on all your Apple devices in Braille access. To use this feature effectively, install the iCloud app from Apple, available from the Microsoft Store. Once set up, navigate to File Explorer, press Windows plus E, then Shift plus Tab to reach the tree view. Press I for iCloud, and your BRF files folder will be there. When you open an existing BRF file on your Apple device through Braille access, it opens in read-only mode by default. To edit a file you've created, press the context menu key, which in Braille access is .7, and select Edit. The BRF functionality includes bookmarks and a find function. When reading, press F chord to search for specific text. the bookmark system is particularly well implemented. Previous and next bookmark functions only appear in the context menu after you've set at least one bookmark, which is good interface design. Navigation is snappy and responsive. Calculator. You can use this feature in either Nemeth Code or UEB Math. In the United States, it defaults to Nemeth. If you enable the visual representation option, teachers can see students' calculations on screen. Live captions. The live captions feature has made a profound difference to my life as someone who wears hearing aids and struggles in difficult acoustical environments. The phone can take input from any specified microphone or from audio playing on your phone. Not only will it transcribe the audio from people speaking in meetings, it turns content like audiobooks into Braille. If you upgrade to iOS 26.1, you will find it will even work on phone and FaceTime calls. For deafblind people, this is transformative. When you're behind in reading the captions, four signs, full Braille cell, appear at the beginning and end of the line to indicate that you have fallen behind real time. Press a cursor routing key to jump to the current line. This works well with another new feature, the ability for your phone to notify you when your name is mentioned. Live captions also includes type-to-speak functionality for deafblind people who do not speak. You can read what someone is saying on your Braille display, then press Enter to type your response, which will be spoken aloud using your personal voice, if you've set one up. Time. The time function displays the current time on your Braille display right down to the second, continuously updating. If you're a chapter president determined to start your meetings right on time, check it out. If you find yourself using a Braille access function regularly, you can bypass the menu entirely by assigning direct commands to specific Braille access functions through your Braille display's command settings. What makes Braille access particularly powerful is that your iPhone itself remains unaffected by Braille access mode. Your Braille display can perform all these Braille functions while your phone continues whatever else you're doing. You could be in a podcast app or reading email while taking notes on your Braille display. Simply toggle Braille access on and off with dots 7 and 8 to move between it and your phone's current app. Essentially, Braille access turns your Braille display into a dedicated standalone note taker powered by your iPhone. For those with Braille displays featuring QWERTY keyboards, Apple has introduced Braille keyboard input mode. Use FDS for dots 1, 2, 3, and JKL for dots 4, 5, 6, with A as dot 7 and semicolon as dot 8. The keyboard command VO plus Y typically invokes this mode. It is my hope that this is only the beginning for Braille access, and that Apple will allocate resources to ensure we see feature enhancements going forward. For example, key players in the Braille arena are collaborating on the new eBraille standard, which will facilitate the production of more navigable files capable of supporting rich content, including graphics. As Apple rolls out support for more multi-line Braille devices, it will be essential for Braille access to support eBraille if it is to stay relevant and on the cutting edge. There are plenty of other accessibility enhancements that have come to our iPhones this year. To learn more about them, I invite you to listen to or read the transcript of Access On, Episode 45, which is devoted to iOS 26 and contains audio demonstrations. Access On is the National Federation of the Blind's technology podcast. We publish a new episode weekly. We also enjoy receiving your feedback, So if you have thoughts on Braille access or other new iOS 26 features, you are most welcome to share them with Access On. And now, an article from Arizona Public Media News entitled, As Arizona Weighs Healthcare Cuts, Tucson Disability Caregivers Seek Support. Care for the Caregivers Tucson chapter holds events regularly to provide a network of resources and social connection among caregivers. By L. M. Boyd. Published November 26, 2025. November is National Family Caregivers Month, and for many Arizonans raising children with disabilities, the timing coincides with an especially uncertain moment. As state officials consider policy changes and reductions to healthcare programs, a Tucson nonprofit is working to support families who often feel the strain. Organizers with local organization Care for the Caregivers offer free counseling, emotional support, and community-building events. Courtney Dieran helps run the Tucson chapter. She said demands for help is rising as families brace for potential cuts to Medicaid and other essential services. We are absolutely approaching a crisis where people need more support, Dieran said. She knows the pressure firsthand as her son relies on specialized medical equipment and therapies. If Medicaid goes away, I don't know how we'll pay to feed him and get him the equipment and doctors he needs, she said. Arizona's deliberations follow the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which will cut about $1 trillion from federal health care programs over the span of the next decade. State agencies are now weighing their own cost-saving measures and policy changes, leaving many families with disabilities worried about losing life-sustaining care. Why we need community. Dieran said her goal is to give caregivers space to unwind, even briefly. On Sunday, November 23rd, volunteers with the nonprofit hosted a watch party for the new film, Wicked for Good, at the Harkins Theater's Tucson Spectrum 18. Jaina Bonfield and her husband Robert were among an audience of caregivers enjoying a couple hours of respite, especially Jaina, who has been a fan of Wicked the musical since high school. I've made him listen to every song on the second half of the soundtrack except the song For Good, she laughed. So, the first time he really hears it is going to be tonight. The Bonfields have three children who all require specialized care. Jaina said she was referred to Care for the Caregivers when she reached a tipping point of stress and isolation. Finding community has helped her weather the lows and celebrate the highs. All the hard stuff is real, but all the good stuff is real too, she said. My kids are freaking hilarious. They're brilliant. They're awesome people. That's why we need community with special needs parents. Someone to listen. Beyond social events, the nonprofit provides support navigating complex healthcare systems and accessing resources. Jody Montelongo, a volunteer board member and registered nurse case manager, said caregivers often neglect their own well-being while coordinating round-the-clock care. Caregivers put their own physical health on the back burner, and then they end up with chronic medical conditions because they're not taking the time to take care of themselves, she said. It's a vicious cycle. Montelongo said even simple moments of connection can make a difference. Sometimes, all caregivers need is just someone to listen, someone to be able to just verbally express all these things, she said. Tragedy in Tucson weighs heavy on caregiver. On Friday, November 21, Tucson police said they suspected two parents murdered their adult son, who had been diagnosed with Down syndrome, before dying by suicide themselves. Tucson officers were responding to a home for a wellness check when they found 51-year-old Shane Stern dead, as well as both his parents, Robert Stern, 74, and Deborah Stern, 73. Police say Shane Stern's quality of life was declining, and that evidence indicates the deaths were planned. Experts say cases in which caregivers harm family members with disabilities are extremely rare and complex, and motivations in this case remain unknown. Disability itself is not a proven cause of violence. For Montelongo, the deaths are devastating and highlight the importance of accessible support systems. Had they known about available resources, you know, and available help, she said. For caregivers struggling with mental health or navigating the system, reaching out is critical, Robert Bonfield said. You are absolutely not alone, he said. I know that that's very basic advice, but it's also very, very helpful. A lot of us are out there. Resources for caregivers of children with disabilities. Care for the caregivers. This nonprofit organization offers free counseling, peer support groups, respite events, and navigation help for families caring for children with significant medical needs. The website is Care for the Caregivers, that's C-A-R numeral 4, T-H-E-C-A-R-E-G-I-V-E-R-S.org. The email address, info@careforthecaregivers.org. Raising Special Kids, Southern Arizona. Arizona's statewide nonprofit for families of children with disabilities or special health care needs offer one-on-one parent support, IEP 504 help, care coordination guidance, workshops, and transition to adulthood resources. The phone number is 520-441-4007. The website is raisingspecialkids.org. AZDES, Division of Developmental Disabilities, DDD. This state agency provides eligibility evaluations and services for children with developmental disabilities, including therapies, habilitation, respite, and support coordination. Phone number is 520-790-4701. The website is azdes.gov/DDD. Arizona Long-Term Care System, it's ALTCS. Arizona's Medicaid Long-Term Care Program for children with extensive medical needs, nursing, therapies, in-home care equipment. Altex also provides eligibility evaluation for caregivers of seniors. The phone number is 888-621-6880. The website is azaccess.gov, that's azaccess.gov/ALTCS. Children's Clinic at TMC. TMC's multi-specialty medical home for children with chronic illnesses, disabilities, and complex medical needs provides care coordination, therapies, family support, and adaptive recreation programs. The phone is 520-324-5437. The website, childrensclinics.org. Mental health and crisis support. Caregivers facing burnout, anxiety, or crisis can dial 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Help is available in English and Spanish. Pima County's crisis line is 520-622-6000. Now here are some tips for caregivers. Ask for and accept help. Focus on what you can do and believe that you're doing the best you can. Follow a daily routine. Learn to say no to requests that are draining, such as hosting meals for holidays or other occasions. Join a support group. People in support groups know what you're dealing with. They can cheer you on and help you solve problems. Seek social support. Take care of your own health. Now, before we read the next article, I want to remind you, this is the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And next, we have a piece from the Arizona Department of Economic Security's Media Center entitled Flipped But Not Broken, Page's Journey to Independence. This was written by Alexandra Gaspar and published November 5th, 2025. When Paige Wellborn was 30, her life changed in an instant. A devastating car accident flipped her vehicle 5 times with her 2 young sons and then husband inside, leaving Paige a quadriplegic. But even in the face of unimaginable adversity, Paige refused to let her circumstances define her future. In the months following the accident, Paige moved into her mother's home, where family members took turns caring for her. The emotional toll was heavy. "I felt like an awful burden to my family and like I could no longer do my job. I had that fear of, what if it's always like this?" said Paige. Determined to reclaim her independence, Paige leaned on the support of Vocational Rehabilitation, VR, to assist her in re-entering the workforce. By the age of 41, she had transformed her life. She became a single mother of 2 and a passionate fourth-grade teacher. Her turning point came when she got divorced from her then-husband and needed to find a job to support her boys. Paige decided to apply for vocational rehabilitation, where she connected with VR counselor Jackie Thornton. Jackie helped Paige explore career options, and she began working with Elevate Career Services. With their assistance, Paige updated her resume, searched for jobs, and applied to a post-baccalaureate teacher certification program. "Jackie also got me in with Drivability, the company that taught me how to drive with hand controls and discussed the options for different vehicles and accommodations with me to find out what would work best for my disability and my lifestyle," said Paige. VR also supported her certification courses, assisted with vehicle modifications, and provided career services, removing barriers that might have otherwise held her back. Today, Paige is still working toward her formal teaching certificate and finds joy in cross-stitching during her free time. Her journey is a testament to resilience, and she shares her hard-earned wisdom with others facing similar challenges. "Don't believe the lie that you cannot still be in charge of your own life. Accept help when you need it, but don't stop trying to learn to be independent and advocate for the things you need. Try to keep a good sense of humor and normalize disability in the world," said Paige. If you or someone you know has a disability and is seeking employment assistance, explore the Vocational Rehabilitation Program. Our next article comes from Art News, the Art in America section. And the article is entitled, "Iconic Photographs of Blind People Prove Seeing Isn't Knowing," by M. Leona Godin, published November 27, 2025. In 1887, a police reporter named Jacob Riis stormed the tenements of New York armed with flashlight powder, an explosive form of magnesium that he would be among the first to enlist as camera flash, in order to shine a light on the darkest corners of poverty. These photos, along with an accompanying text, became How the Other Half Lives, 1890. It was in this book that I found the photo Upstairs in Blind Man's Alley. Blind Man's Alley was located at 26 Cherry Street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. According to Riis, It got its name because its dark burrows harbored a colony of blind beggars, tenants of a blind landlord, old Daniel Murphy, who made a tremendous amount of money, $400,000, more than $40 million today, from the alley and surrounding tenements. As a blind person myself, I enlisted help from ChatGPT, which gives me elaborate image descriptions and allows me to ask questions about what it sees. It described a dimly lit, cramped tenement room with rough, cracked walls and a low ceiling. Three figures are arranged around a small cast iron stove with a kettle resting on top, including one woman with a weary expression and loosely tied hair. Elsewhere, I read that in his attempt to photograph Blind Man's Alley, Rias nearly burned the whole place down. After the blinding effect of the flash had passed away, he discovered that a lot of paper and rags that hung on the walls were ablaze. It was just him and several blind people in an attic room with a dozen crooked rickety stairs between them and the street. He managed to smother the fire with a vast deal of trouble and claimed that the blind people were unaware of their danger. However, if I imagine myself as the blind woman, I feel the heat of the flames licking the walls, the shock of the flash still ringing in my ears. I suspect I might have wondered what good it would do to show pictures of us to the other half, as if they'd care to look. Identifying with the blind woman may skew my reading, but this is certain. The picture shows people who lived outside this sliver of flash, out in the world with its vast complexities. Oftentimes, viewers believe in the truth of photographs, just as Rias believed in his ability to reveal the truth of tenement life. But as Georgina Klieg reminds us in her 2018 book, More Than Meets the Eye, What Blindness Brings to Art, absolute objectivity is neither possible nor desirable. Although she is speaking about verbal description as a form of access, her point applies broadly. Whether capturing, viewing, or describing an image, we always bring with us our own biases, affinities, and ways of seeing. Nearly 30 years after Rias took his tenement photos, a young photographer named Paul Strand hit the streets of New York City with a camera that had a false lens, a prism lens, that allowed him to photograph people without their awareness. The device made it seem as though his camera was pointed elsewhere. One fall day in 1916, he happened upon a blind woman selling newspapers on the street, where he took one of the most iconic photos of the 20th century. The photo's title was New York 1916, when it was first published in Camera Work, the photography journal edited and published by Alfred Stieglitz. It has since come to be known as Blind Woman. It features a tight shot of a white woman in a black tunic and headscarf standing against a masonry wall. She wears a bold hand-painted sign that reads, Blind. Her head is turned to her left, and her right eye, the one closest to the camera, is half-closed and cloudy, while her left eye seems directed towards something beyond the frame, drawing the viewer's gaze there, then back to her sign. Above the sign is a small metal brooch. A human informant, disabled artist Finnegan Shannon, told me that they had to zoom way in to read the text around this brooch, but was able to make out that it says, Licensed Peddler, New York City. It was apparently not so easy to obtain these peddlers' licenses. A 1921 New York Times article featured the harried commissioner of licenses who is sometimes inclined to feel that it would be easier to arbitrate a world war than to decide which of several applicants should enjoy the privilege of selling newspapers. The blind woman's dealings with bureaucracy are just one of the many unseen things in this photo. We often ask photography to tell us the truth, as if its mechanical methods offer inherently neutral observations, even as we know it inevitably leaves so much invisible. These and other iconic photographs of anonymous blind lay bare erroneous ideas of what vision can do. In taking photos of blind people, did these photographers grapple with the camera's limitation to communicate knowledge? At its best, photography, an alchemy of light, transcends what is merely seen to evoke multisensory realms beyond. Sight itself is not independent. It is interpreted in the brain, shaped by experience. Ocular centrism, the privileging of sight over the other senses, persists nevertheless. Despite its eye-catching power, Strand's photo cannot tell the story of a whole and complex life, especially when viewed through the lens of fear or pity. Strand recalled the blind newspaper peddler as one of those whom life had battered into some sort of extraordinary interest. His words reflect a common assumption that equates disability with suffering, one that is so pervasive that it has been trained into AI, or so I learned when ChatGPT told me, the image conveys a sense of dignity and quiet strength despite the woman's evident vulnerability. This may be overly optimistic, but when ChatGPT says something I don't like, I make it a teachable moment. Why do you say she is vulnerable? Is that not assuming something about blindness that is not in the photo? Thank you for the clarification, it said, and offered a new bias-free description. Without a fragile human ego, AI seems more willing to be wrong and to alter behavior accordingly than most of us do. Our sight is conditioned. Sarah Lewis describes this in The Unseen Truth, When Race Changed Sight in America, 2024. Speaking of how what we see is shaped by history, habit, and ideology, we can learn to see and unsee things through photography. As with race, when we look at disability, what we see is conditioned by iteration and rhetoric. While it is true that those making a living on the street may not have the cushiest of lifestyles, it is still ableist to assume that disabled people's lives revolve around suffering, as Strand and ChatGPT both did. Many of our lives run counter to the usual stories about disability as only bad news, the curse everyone wants to avoid, Rosemary Garland Thompson wrote in her introduction to About Us, 2019, an anthology of essays from the New York Times Disability Series. She continues, "We do not necessarily understand our ways of being in the world as disadvantage, diminishment, or distress." In the absence of Strand's subject's voice, I turned to that of a contemporaneous blind woman featured in another 1921 Times article called Cheating the Blind, Sad Experiences of Sightless News Dealers. There I met Fanny Lyons, who also sold newspapers with her husband at the southeast corner of 34th Street and 7th Avenue. When asked if people tried to cheat them, she laughed heartily. "Do they, honey? Why, they'd take the eyes out of our head if we had them and didn't watch out." Perhaps we can keep Fanny Lyons and her hearty laughter in mind when we look back at Strand's blind woman and resist the urge to assume vulnerability or unmitigated suffering, instead allowing for the possibility that her life also contained love and joy. I first encountered Walker Evans's 1938 photograph of a blind accordion player in The Ongoing Moment, 2005, by Jeff Dyer, who describes the subway busker as having eyes that are clamped shut, downturned like the mouth of someone so habituated to unhappiness as to feel comfortable with it. Yet not everyone sees unhappiness in this blind accordion player. Several informants noted that he appears to be singing the penultimate note of his sweet song with the intensity of an artist. ChatGPT concurred, describing the accordion player as standing in the middle of a packed subway car mid-performance, his mouth open as if singing or calling out, and contrasts his tousled hair and expressive face with the rigid postures of the seated riders, some absorbed in newspapers, others staring blankly ahead. The accordion player in this reading is dynamic, while the sighted passengers sit quiet and still. This is the final photo in Evans's book of subway portraits, and it is strikingly different from the rest. All his other subway photos are of passengers seated across the car from him. Because of their proximity and presumed sightedness, Evans hid his 35mm camera beneath his coat, but the spy tactics seemed unnecessary for the blind accordion player. Perhaps that was part of the appeal. Here was a subject who could not look back. These three photos of anonymous blind people are but a tiny sample. It feels like every major photographer in the 20th century took an anonymous blind person photo. It's entirely possible that Strand's blind woman, with her bold sign, started it all. We know for sure that the photo inspired Walker Evans. After seeing it in camera work at the New York Public Library, he said to himself, "That's the stuff. That's the thing to do." It may seem obvious why sighted photographers might be obsessed with blind people. Blindness represents a huge fear for many. But for photographers, that fear is magnified. Sight is not just their primary sense, but their artistic sense, and they see precise and expressive vision as their way of knowing the world. As Evans once bragged, "I had a real eye." Yet, despite the importance he placed on seeing, Evans famously called photography the most literary of the graphic arts, hinting at an art form suspended between simple legibility and the deeper understanding that unfolds with time and effort. Photography promises to show us the world, but as these three images remind us, seeing is not the same as knowing. Blindness, so often feared and flattened in visual culture, destabilizes the easy truths of the photograph. As Bojana Cocklett asks in Alt Text Selfies, a chapbook of self-portraits made entirely of words, how much are we missing by just looking? Removing sight from its pedestal can open new multi-sensory realms of perception. Reading photographs through a blind, critical gaze, a gaze that resists pity and seeks complexity, offers not just new ways of looking, but new ways of knowing. And now an article from The 19th, entitled, "How Rosa Parks' Legacy Inspired a New Fight Over Who Could Ride the Bus." Decades after the Montgomery bus boycott, these activists in Chicago turned to Parks' playbook to broaden disability access. By Lauren Nuttall, published December 1, 2025. Decades after her act of defiance, Rosa Parks galvanized a cadre of activists to protest their own conditions and, through the scope of her legacy, for them, is still coming into focus, it remains just as powerful. They were fighting for disability access, and, like Parks, they used public transportation as a springboard. The disability rights movement took shape against the backdrop of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, growing in size with each passing year. By the 1980s, it had made strides, successfully passing legislation and increasing the visibility of people living with disabilities. But on roads and rails, Small advances made in bus accessibility throughout the years did little to meet the needs of commuters with disabilities, whose use of public transportation was severely limited. Oftentimes, they were relegated to use separate services entirely, relying on transit services such as Dial-A-Ride, which required passengers to request a pickup and were frequently unreliable. In 1984, something changed. In Chicago, about a dozen wheelchair-bound activists from the disability rights group ADAPT placed themselves in front of city buses to protest the Chicago Transit Authority's decision to purchase more than 350 buses, none of which were accessible to them due to the city's refusal to pay for wheelchair lifts. The demonstration was reminiscent of Parks' own protest that had taken place more than 700 miles south and nearly 30 years prior, when she refused to vacate her seat for a white passenger. As law enforcement officers arrived at the scene, a single sentence was emblazoned on each protester's name tags. "My name is Rosa Parks." We used a lot of the tactics that were used by Dr. King and Gandhi, and we were inspired by the fact that Rosa Parks, as a black woman, couldn't even really sit at the front of the bus. And those of us who use wheelchairs couldn't even get on the bus, said Anita Cameron, director of minority outreach at Not Dead Yet, a disability rights group. Cameron has volunteered at ADAPT and worked in transportation advocacy for several decades. ADAPT's own relationship with Parks was complex. Years after that fateful protest in Chicago, she was invited to join an event with the organization in Detroit, an offer she declined. "We tried to get Rosa Parks to join us, and she wasn't able to, and that upset a lot of people," said Cameron. "Didn't upset me, because I felt that Rosa Parks had already done her thing, done great things. You know, as a black disabled woman, I certainly couldn't get upset with Rosa Parks. Get upset with another black woman who paid her dues and went through what she went through." Still, Parks' influence was crucial in the disability rights movement. The Chicago protest kicked off a years-long battle for disability rights. After a flurry of legislation, formal complaints, and more demonstrations around the country, it eventually culminated in the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, in 1990. It's interesting because Rosa Parks is mostly known as a civil rights activist, and the act of civil disobedience and kind of her advocacy around segregation, racial segregation on buses and transportation, said Alex Elagudin, who co-founded Wheeling Forward, an advocacy organization for people with disabilities. It's amazing how that has both inspired and morphed and kind of led future work by disability advocates. In the years that followed Parks' protest, other movements, including the LGBTQ plus rights movement, made their own progress, an achievement for which Elagudin also gives credit to Parks. A lot of the work and belief that it's possible comes from the civil rights movement and individuals like Rosa Parks, he said. As the country moves away from the progressive measures that people like Parks set in motion, Cameron shared that those living with disabilities will be monumentally harmed. "I mean, our rights aren't just being stripped away," she said. "They're potentially being replaced with extraordinarily repressive, oppressive measures. Some measures which may wind a lot of us disabled dead." When Cameron was born, the Voting Rights Act had not yet been passed, and people living with disabilities were not able to get an education. As she came of age and was inspired by figures like Parks, she became heavily involved in disability advocacy. "As a black person, as someone who's disabled, I look at the things that Rosa Parks did and the fight that she fought, and I'm especially grateful because we're losing," she said. "The very rights she once fought for are slowly being taken away. I have lived through enough history, she said. I took part in the fight for the ADA. I took part in the Capitol crawl, the Rotunda takeover. Took part in the fight for Medicaid back in 2017 and whatnot. I can't tell you how many times I've chained myself to the White House fence and been arrested at the White House during Democrat and Republican administrations fighting for disability rights. And to see that go away, it's extraordinarily scary, but we have to still keep fighting. For her, Parks's influence on the disability rights movement and the civil rights movement is a paradigm for civil disobedience, and it's one she hopes to continue. Her courage inspired us, she said. Rosa Parks could do what she did in a time when black folks had no rights. We disabled could do this at a time where we at least have minimal human rights. As she moves forward, Cameron hopes to continue to share the importance of Parks's life. I can do nothing but honor her as an ancestor and honor her memory. And that's all the time we have today. Thanks for tuning in to the Disability News. This is John Curry, your volunteer reader. Please do join us again next time.